So we're making better decisions, and the fruit quality should even be better on this next go around.
In the present, I need to evolve, I need to change lots of things.
Okay, I think a few times they asked me, Giovanni, do you have fun in what you're doing?
Well, you reinvent yourself, right? I think that's really where that begins and ends.
I think 18's legendary. It's going to go down in history.
I haven't made the same wine twice, have no intention of duplicating anything.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 350. This week we feature Brooke Bannister of Bannister Wines in Sonoma.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Brooke Bannister entered the wine business after his mother, who started the business, had to step away. But it's not that simple. Bannister Wines had its beginnings in an uncommon way. Brooke continued his mom's endeavor and became a winemaker after growing up surrounded by the business. We met with Brooke at the cellar in Healdsburg during a quiet Sunday morning, surrounded by the sleeping barrels. You can also hear Brooke in our Vino Lingo segment defining the wine term wild yeast.
Well, we're back in Sonoma, and we're at Bannister Wines with Brooke Bannister. How you doing, Brooke?
Good, thank you.
It's good to see you. I guess my first question is, this is a facility, a custom crush facility?
It is a custom crush facility, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's probably five or six wineries here, all cool. Under one roof.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the beginning. First of all, when did you start Bannister Wines?
Well, actually, my mom started it, so it was her business. She founded the first laboratory for wine services.
Really?
Yep, in the late 70s. She and a friend just rented a little storefront in downtown Healdsburg. 1979, there was nothing there. There was like a Greyhound station and a hardware store, a couple of biker bars, and put in this kind of makeshift lab to provide wine services, and ended up being like right place, right time. And it kind of really took off with the wine industry because small producers just didn't have anywhere to take samples or get winemaking products before she provided that service. So that kind of got her like really involved in the wine industry, and then she got interested in winemaking. So after 10 years working in the lab, she founded our label, which is Bannister Wines, and that was always kind of a smaller, I don't want to say side project, she put a lot of passion into it, but she kept working, running the lab, and then would kind of make the wines during harvest. She was doing consulting winemaking for a number of different people, so she would just have her fruit brought to wherever she was doing the consulting winemaking, and then have them crush, process for her, and sell her the wine there.
She was a busy woman.
Yeah, really busy.
Wow.
Yeah.
You don't very commonly hear women starting businesses like this, especially on her own, which is really impressive.
Yeah, it is. It was really impressive. And for me, I just kind of took that for granted growing up, having a mom that did all that. But later on, as you go other places and everything kind of falls into context, then I realized that was kind of rare at the time. And especially if coming from a middle-class background into an industry that's often like wineries are started by people that have a lot of money or companies that have a lot of money. So, you know, it was just get a loan and work hard and make the business work. There were some women, you know, at her time, there were some, you know, kind of, she was a small group of trailblazers then.
That's a good word, trailblazers, because these days there are many women in all parts of the wine business, but especially winemakers.
Yeah, there are. And I think I have the experience that women seem to have better palates than men,
actually.
That's
what they say. Yeah. And I believe that because many of the women I've tasted with pick up things I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of like, no, it's not really an even playing field. They have the advantage.
Yeah, that may be true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool. This is not a job of the faint at heart. I mean, it's a very physical job.
Yeah, it is. You know, for us, we make such a small amount of wine. Like, it's, there's not a lot of equipment involved dealing with these really small amounts. I think when you get into those large production facilities, then, you know, then you're on the forklift all the time, you know, then you're moving hoses all day. So I actually, for me, the amount of work I do, we only make 1,000 cases a year. So, you know, it's hard work during harvest, but the cellar work the rest of the year is kind of low impact.
Sure. Yeah, I get that. But I mean, it's still something you have to really know your way around the place and you have to learn anything.
Yeah.
And you mentioned it, especially right there. Every winemaker I've met, doesn't matter male or female, you guys are all experts at running forklifts, and that's a scary thing. That's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's impressive. So I just thought I'd go down that path for no particular
reason. I got you. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess I never even think about that stuff. You know, it's kind of second nature. So it's, yeah, there's something insane about stacking barrels this high.
So you said you make 1,000 cases, and what are you making? We have some wines behind you, but. So
we focus on Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, a little bit of Zinfandel, a little bit of Rosé, and a little bit of Riesling. My mom, when she got interested in winemaking specifically, she was interested in Pinot Noir because at the time in the 80s, you know, there's just a handful of people making Pinot Noir in the, you know, west side Russian River Valley here. Nobody outside of this area really thought of California as a, you know, Pinot Noir producing, or somewhere that you would get great Pinot Noir from. Like, it was, you know, it was still a secret. And those guys were kind of, those men and women were kind of working in the dark to a certain degree, because their wines weren't widely known. And Pinot Noir was very tricky, you know. It's tricky to grow, it's tricky to make wine out of. So they were still like doing a lot of work just to kind of figure it out and get consistency from harvest to harvest. And I think the challenge of that interested my mom. She met Joe Swan and did some, you know, consulting, kind of thinking, throwing ideas around with people like that. And so that really got her interested. So that's what she focused on when she started the brand.
Is your mom still living?
She is, yeah. She lives in town.
Oh, great. Yeah. Is she in any way, shape, or form involved in business?
To a certain degree, yeah. She got Lyme disease and had to retire a little earlier than she had wanted to. And that's actually kind of why I ended up getting involved in the family business. I hadn't planned to go into the wine industry, actually, but when she had to walk away from this, I didn't want to see kind of all her work disappear and her story get lost, so I kind of jumped in to get involved. I made a kind of like late career change to do this. And I'd learned winemaking growing up from her in a really casual way, so I was comfortable doing that, but I'd never been involved really in the business side of it, so now I kind of take care of everything. But going back to your question, I keep my mom involved in tasting and talking about protocol. And, you know, she has 40 years of experience, and you're always running into issues or, you know, new challenges with a given harvest. And so for somebody that has that much experience, there's a lot of things to go back to kind of, you know, look at as comparisons and ways to solve problems or to provide some insight into, you know, all the different things that come up in the course of winemaking.
Well, and I'm sure she appreciates being part of it still.
Yeah, for sure.
That's got to be a big deal to her, considering those 40 years you mentioned.
Yeah, and this is about her. Like, I'm not, I have other creative outlets in my life, so I'm not somebody that, like, needs to be known as the winemaker. Like, I want to just keep our family business going, keep the name on the bottle, make really good wines, and have it be about my mom and her story. So that's kind of my goal with the whole operation.
Did you acquire a passion though for it? I mean, is this something that,
you know, I always liked wine. I never gave it much thought. It was so just much in our life that for me it was just like, it was always in the house. I was always, you know, going to work with my mom, you know, either at her laboratory or out in a vineyard or, you know, where she was making the wine. I don't know, it's something, when you grow up with something, you just don't really, I guess, think about it in those terms exactly, like whether it was something that I was passionate about or not. I just knew it so intimately that it just was there. So, but I didn't really give it serious thought till she had to walk away from it. And then I thought, you know, I don't want to see this disappear. So, and I also really like problem solving. I like making things. I had a furniture building business before this. So for me, just like taking a material and making something is kind of what gets me going. And I don't really like the business side of the wine industry.
Nobody does.
But so, you know, the passion's, yeah, I guess, in the winemaking part, just turning these amazing grapes we grow right here in this beautiful little, you know, Sonoma County, and turning it into this really interesting living product that people can experience. That part's really cool. Business side, can't wait to not have to deal with that.
The classic necessary evil.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back. You had a furniture building business. This was a creative idea that you came up with. You've been doing this for a while, or
I messed around with that stuff a little bit growing up. My dad was a carpenter. My grandfathers were both builders, so I had tons of tools around. And
it was in your blood.
Yeah, and I just really like making things, starting projects, and then actually, I like going into things not really even knowing how to do it, just kind of figuring it out as I'm going. It's that kind of autodidact form of learning, and I can't really learn in the classroom setting. I need to just get in there and do it. So, yeah, and actually, there's a great wine label out in Alexander Valley called Hawks, and Jacob Hawks, one of my best friends growing up, he and I actually moved to Oakland in our early 20s and started the furniture business together. And he had to peel off and go back to help his family kind of early on. And then I kept doing it for another 10 years or so. Just anything you could think of that was like custom project, people wanted metal. We did lots of welding, lots of high-end woodwork kind of stuff.
Cool. So a little more artistic.
Yeah, it was very artistic. Yeah. So like restaurant work, hotels, you know, like when people did remodels, they wanted to update. And then a lot of private homes, you know, just like custom tables, you know, big stuff, expensive stuff.
Interesting. Wow. Did you end up having to close the business to come back?
Or you know, I kind of did, yeah. But it kind of run its course a certain degree, too. I had a warehouse in Oakland, and the lease was up on that. My wife wanted to move back here, so there was just kind of, it made it easy to a certain degree to change careers then, because I couldn't scale that business back up Sonoma County, you know?
Yeah, right.
Industrial spaces are cheap in Oakland. You can have a business down there that requires an industrial space. It would cost so much more to do it up here. So I just wasn't ready to do all that. And then, you know, the clientele were down there and so on. So anyway, it worked out okay.
Well, obviously you grew up here.
Yeah, I did.
And then what a contrast though, living in Oakland. I mean, you're in the city and right around the corner, but still a very different place to be.
Yeah, it's, you know. It couldn't be more different. But I kind of like the extremes. I like the, you know, really country, rural, you know, forests, or the just total urban chaos. I like both those things.
So we talked about wines a minute ago. We didn't get all the way through them. Tell me specifically about each of the wines you make.
Okay, so we do a number of Pinot Noirs, and that's the main thing we've always done. The Pinot Noir market in this country is kind of a mess as far as I'm concerned. There's just way too much. Too many vineyards have been planted. That's not to say that there isn't really good Pinot Noir. I mean, there's a lot of really good Pinot Noir, but there are so many brands. There's so many more brands coming on. I don't know. I feel like the varietal is kind of losing a little bit of focus overall. But that's what we, and so I'm branching out a little bit into some other things, but that's what we started with originally. Bannister Wines was making really good Pinot Noir. So what we do now is there's three vineyards we work with, four depending on the year, and really try and spread them out through different parts of Sonoma County, because there's nowhere else on planet Earth that has as many microclimates as Sonoma County does in the same geographic footprint. So really want people to see that, like, you can go all the way up to the northwest corner of Sonoma County, have a perfectly suited climate for Pinot Noir, middle of Sonoma County. Our particular vineyard there is on the Occidental Ridge, and then actually another one that's on the back of San Francisco Bay in the southern tip of Sonoma County. So people have the ability, when they're drinking our wines, to kind of understand the geography, understand that you've got all these different weather and temperature influencers that are impacting different parts of the county and allow us to grow Pinot Noir in these widely kind of scattered spots. And that's really interesting to me, and I like being able to kind of teach people that. Then Chardonnay we do from a little part of Alexander Valley called the Narrows. There's some old plantings that are long kind of flood deposits, little benches that are, when really you've left the valley and it's going down through the hills to kind of make the turn to Healdsburg. It's just this amazing little kind of hidden section down there that produces really fine, more delicate style of Chardonnay. We do a little rosé because the market demands it.
Is it rosé Pinot?
It is Pinot Noir, yeah. It's actually a Saunier, so it bleeds from Pinot. It's not pressed.
Sure.
Red grapes. It's actually juice from the Pinots that's stolen and fermented separately. And then we do a really nice Zinfandel from Saini out in Dry Creek. Great, great Zinfandel vineyard. Great spot there. This kind of eastern, little higher bench when you're halfway out through the valley. We do about 130 cases of that, really small production. And then the Riesling, we do this skin contact, a little more experimental style wine.
Yeah, a little different color. Mm-hmm. Yeah. About how many cases are you doing the Riesling?
I think the 2018 was 110 cases.
And just to be clear for our listeners, this is a dry Riesling we're talking
about. It is about. Completely
just
dry.
Just want to make sure you say that. Yeah. What do you like about making wine in this kind of a facility?
And one of the actual really cool things about making wine here is that it has shown definitively that you don't need real fancy equipment to make good wine. You know, I'll go to like these really fancy Pinot Noir houses, and you know, they've just got hundreds of thousands of dollars of specialized equipment for, you know, getting each berry perfectly off of each cluster, and the wines aren't any better. We have an old crusher destemmer made by the Heelsburg Machine Company in the 1960s. And, we have ways to just kind of temporarily set it up to be a little more gentle. So when I'm processing Pinot, you know, we do that, but it's not like the modern Italian stuff you can get that spits out each berry perfectly. And, you know, the press we have is pretty rudimentary, but can kind of get tricky with it to mimic like the fancier basket presses that are used on Pinot. You don't need a lot of fancy stuff. It's cool.
You asked me before we set up if I was familiar with Sonoma wines, and I am. And while Pinot is certainly, you know, the king grape out here as well as Chardonnay, Cabernet from here is really great. Mm-hmm. Different than Napa Cabernet. Have you considered that at all, or is that just not?
You know, I haven't considered it. You know, I appreciate the Cabernets that come from here. I think there's Hillside Alexander Cabernet that's as good as anything comes out of Napa. And I think the drinking public's starting to catch on to that. But for us, always focusing on Burgundy for the most part, and then, you know, Zinfandel, what we call that American. I just think the brand would lose focus moving in, adding something like Cabernet.
It was a purely selfish question because I've had some Cabernets over here that are just great.
Yeah.
And they're all more reasonably priced.
Yep.
So that's why I brought it up.
Yeah. But the other thing I'll add is that when you go to a vineyard, it does this thing where you look at it and you're like, oh, I'd like to make some wine from here. So yeah, in this kind of hypothetical world, yeah, I'd like to make some Cabernet because I see interesting Cabernet vineyards all the time, and you always wonder like what are the possibilities. But in terms of the focus on the business, like that's probably wouldn't fit well with the profile.
That's where that evil business side sneaks in. So is everything you're doing pretty much direct to consumer or otherwise?
It's a split right now because we had 7 years where we didn't make any wine at all. Between when my mom had gotten sick, had to retire, and I was still in Oakland, I couldn't really do this till I moved back here. And so I got production restarted in 13. So I didn't have Pinot Noir ready for sale until 2016. So right now, you know, we're in 2019 now. So I've only had wines back in the market for 3.5 years, really. So I'm some DTC, some wholesale, you know, trying to grow the DTC back to to where it needs to be to make a 1,000-case production brand work financially.
Just kind of a reestablishing.
Yeah.
And I assume you have a wine club then.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, we'll come back to that in a few minutes. How many years have you personally been making wine?
Since 13.
Okay. For all the times you have talked to media people, what is the question that you don't get asked that you would like to be asked? What's the one thing you really like to talk about that people don't talk about?
Boy. You know, I don't do a lot of media stuff, but I want to answer your question, so
please
let me think about it.
Take a minute.
I think, you know, more than a specific question, I guess the subject of how this isn't necessarily related to winemaking, but more just the general nature of wine, but how we cut through all of the misconceptions about wine to the consumer and make it really plain to consumers what's actually and who are actually these small family producers and who is making really authentic wines that really actually show the terroir, show the the characteristics of the varietal, show the, you know, the hand of the winemaker and the person that grew it. Like that's to me been the most challenging thing, because the amount of the marketing budgets of big wineries is so substantial, and they do such a good job at it, that there are wineries that make hundreds of thousands of cases that people think are family wineries. So it's this really interesting challenge to actually find a way through that and get your wine to the consumer, because people want that. They want a relationship with the winery, but it's just not a direct route. And that's been the thing that's been interesting to me. That's been the great question for me, is how to get to people.
It's a good answer. Well, I think it just comes down to the tastings and people meeting you. Mm-hmm. One of the things we love to do as Life Between the Vines is introduce people to people like you. We certainly do interview bigger wineries, but small wineries are where it's at.
Mm-hmm, for sure, yeah.
I mean, how many people get to talk to winemakers and you know, get that information from you?
Yeah.
That's a big deal to people.
It is, yeah. So that, I mean, when I get people in, you know, in front of the wines and get to sit down with them, it's successful. You know, people appreciate that. People want to collect the wines, join the wine club. It's just a matter of, yeah, making the connection.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of options too, and there's a lot of good options if people are up here, so.
Sure. Well, especially I think Sonoma, you get certainly see more of the families. Like they're a bit more apparent.
Yeah.
A little less hidden.
Yeah.
Because you have the bigger wineries.
I think to a certain degree, the question we were discussing was on a kind of a national level.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, when people do a search for, you know, small Pinot Noir producer, you know, how do you come up in that search?
That's an interesting question. There's a big fight for shelf space if it's in retail. Getting into restaurants is a challenge. I mean, mm-hmm. when you're a small maker, no matter what, you really have a mountain in front of you.
Yeah.
How do you get past that?
I mean, I don't exactly have an answer for you. I mean, relationships are really important in this business, obviously. So, you know, I've got a really good relationship in Chicago. I have a distributor there, and I have wine club members there, and people look for the wines, and that's been successful. And that just took meeting people, you know, being nice to them, sharing the story with them, and that got me some traction there. Yeah, for small producers and you know, distribution's getting consolidated in this country too. So little books have been bought up by big books, and they don't want to hand sell wines because that's not as productive as just doing volume deals on cheaper stuff. So I think we need to get creative to a certain degree on how we sell the wine. I mean, there are more online sellers, you know, coming on into the market. And I think those have a lot of potential for selling wines because they can tell your story to their mailing list and get people interested. So there's just going to be new solutions. But the straight just distribution thing is not going to work for little producers really anymore.
It's simply kind of the voice in a crowd theory, isn't it? Really, you know, getting your hand up and getting somebody to pay attention.
Yeah.
But again, listeners love to talk to people like you because they get the personal treatment, which is a big deal.
The phone number on our website just goes to my cell phone. So,
and that's a cool thing. We're going to come back to that, and somebody could talk to the winemaker, which is something I love to talk about. So all this in mind, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
Crazy in a good way? Or just drives
me crazy.
Let's start
with a good way.
Well, there's, anytime you make something and then it gets experienced by somebody else, you know, you've made this connection. And to me, that's special, and that's paramount to doing this. You know, the wine just could end up with somebody you never met or maybe never will meet, but you now have that connection with them when they open that wine in a restaurant, you know, 2,000 miles away or something. Also seeing how the product evolves, you know, you make it, it's in the cellar here for a year, you bottle it, and then, you know, opening it up a year down the road, 3 years down the road, seeing the evolution of the wine is really interesting. And because you've had this experience with it since it was a baby, so just to kind of see that, the life cycle of it's, that's really interesting to me. That keeps me fascinated. As far as what drives me crazy, I mean, I touched on the business side earlier. Just the amount of spinning of the wheels you have to do to get a little bit of response is kind of surprising. Because when I came from, you know, furniture building business, like if you sent somebody an email, they responded. If they sent you an email, you responded. The wine industry is just this kind of like, you're just shouting in the dark a lot of the time. You know, people, it's become commonplace to not respond to people. And I don't actually like being part of that environment, because I just think courtesy is really important. So for me, that's tough to navigate. And I didn't set the rules. They're not my rules. I kind of decided to step into this thing. The rules were already made. So it's kind of tough for me to deal with that, because it's just not the way I look at the world. But.
Sure. That's a good answer. I think it's time for all of us to get a little lesson on courtesy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the wine business will always be a challenge. The good thing about it is it's evolved, and it's gone quite a ways in terms of reaching people that may not have drank wine of this caliber. Would you agree?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I always say this thing, like, people used to go to public tastings because they were looking to find a wine that they really liked and, you know, then wanted to be able to purchase and go back to it again and again. Well, now people have found their wines. Like, they don't need to go to public tastings. There's so many other ways to get in contact with, you know, a wine you would like, or just to, you know, do a search and order some things that look interesting to you. And you couldn't do that 20 years ago. So, yeah, there's so many ways to get to the finish line for the consumer now.
Yeah. Well, and just to kind of go back to your tastings a bit, what do you find is the greatest challenge to, when you're dealing with somebody who isn't really an experienced wine drinker, but they're maybe afraid, oh, Riesling, it's going to be sweet. And you could certainly say it's not sweet.
You know, I don't really find a challenge with that. I think for me, like you were saying earlier, people don't get a chance to just sit down with a winemaker a lot of time. So once we've done that, we're sitting down together, I think that makes people actually at ease, and they're interested and they're open-minded about things. And they're also getting, I think I'm able to create a situation where people are comfortable asking questions, showing that they, you know, there are things they don't know about wine, which is understandable. Like, most people don't know very much about wine. So it's, you know, and people want to find a setting they can be in and ask those questions without, you know, feeling silly about it. So I find that's a really good setup, actually. The, you know, me sitting down with people and them getting to ask questions works really well.
That's another good answer. Very good. And so for our listeners who would like to learn a little bit about you and maybe do a tasting, I assume they would do that online. And if that's true,
yeah.
What is your website?
BannisterWines.com. That's BannisterWines, plural.com. The phone number is 707-387-0124.
And you know, we were just talking a second ago that people don't call, but the idea of being able to talk to a winemaker, for me, while that might be intimidating, it's not. This is a guy you can ask those questions to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a cool thing.
And it's a one-person operation, so I pick up the phone when it rings.
Yeah, that's nice. Brooke, thanks for taking the time, and I have to put a little plug in for Alice Sutro, who was very kind to contact you and set this up for us. So thank you out there, Alice. And Brooke, thanks for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Learn more by visiting BannisterWines.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.